Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr and Mrs.
Oh, no,
I don't,
yes.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Hello there, and welcome to the Times Business Podcast, where we're going to look ahead to the stories and the events that are going to be grabbing the headlines and moving markets in the coming days. I'm Robert Miller. This week, I'm going to let the EU President, Donald Tusk, introduce the podcast.
There's no reason to pretend that this is a happy day, neither in Brussels nor in London.
Nicely done, sir. Well, to help me inject some light on this and hopefully leave you in an optimistic frame of mind, I'm joined by Robert Lee, the industrial editor of The Times, Marcus LaRue, our trade correspondent, and Callum Jones, The Times markets reporter. Welcome to you all. Before I start with you, Bob Lee, this is how the Prime Minister set out what she wants from Brexit.
I want us to be a truly global Britain, the best friend and neighbour to our European partners, but a country that reaches beyond the borders of Europe too. A country that goes out into the world to build relationships with old friends and new allies alike. And that is why I have set out a clear and ambitious plan for the negotiations ahead. It is a plan for a new, deep and special partnership between Britain and the European Union. A partnership of values, a partnership of interests, a partnership based on cooperation in areas such as security and economic affairs. And a partnership that works in the best interests of the United Kingdom, the European Union and the wider world.
Bob, the Prime Minister there, it sounds wonderful, doesn't it? But looking ahead in terms of this podcast, we've got some SMMT, Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders figures coming out next week. I mean, first of all, what sort of reaction, what are they going to do now, if you like, to get on board with these Brexit talks? What can they do to help themselves?
Well, what we get next week is the new car registrations, the sales figures for March, which will be interesting enough in themselves because it'll give us a very good sort of window into how the consumer economy is going. Interestingly enough, in terms of the car sales, they've been down in two of the last 3 months, and the industry generally is expecting a slowdown in car sales. The really important stuff, of course, is what you're alluding to, is what the British car industry is actually about. And this is where we're talking about the manufacturers. There's a cloud hanging over Vauxhall, which is up in Cheshire and in Luton. There's a cloud over the Ford engine factory in South Wales. But there's upsides as well. Geely, the Chinese motor manufacturer, has just opened a plant just north of Coventry to make the new London cabs. So it's a bit of a curate's egg. And if you speak to anyone in the automotive industry, they actually just don't know where things are going either.
You can see how important this industry is to ministers right now. Only this week they've released their meetings with various private and public officials over, I think, between the months of September and December. And if you look at who the business ministers have been meeting, it's wall-to-wall people from this industry. So it's people from various companies, it's people from SMMT, and it's very interesting that these are the people that they're spending the most time talking to.
From the trade perspective, the car manufacturers are probably, you know, the emblematic example of the difficulties between extricating yourself from the European Union at the same time as turning towards a newfangled global marketplace because of the nature of the supply chain. That, and this is true of other sectors as well, that so much of British manufacturing relies on efficient, specialised suppliers with parts crisscrossing the channel. So I suppose the car industry is one of the biggest affected exports was one of the industries with the most at stake through these negotiations, but it's also probably the epitome of the challenges of untangling yourself from Europe and meeting, you know, Liam Fox and Theresa May's vision of a global free trading buccaneering Britain.
The thing about the car industry at the moment is it's a bit of a cliche amongst the executives, but they all say it's going to change within the next 3 to 5 years more than it has done in the previous 100 years. And ministers have just committed 100 million matched by the industry, so 200 million to actually start investing in the next generation of automotive, which is autonomous, self-driving, driverless cars. That plus electrification of vehicles means that the motor vehicle of 2025 will bear no relation to the one that's actually being produced and has been produced in this country. So the real wins for this this industry in the UK is to actually get at the ground floor of automation and of electrification.
I was going to say, Callum, this is one of the areas that's interested me. I saw the announcement that Bob's talking there about. I did actually wonder what it was. I thought it was self-driving cars, but I wasn't sure. There must be some of these semi-biotech companies, aren't there? Those are the companies people really should be looking at. You're looking for the star of tomorrow, someone who's going to produce the longest-lasting battery, the most intelligent software. So there must be opportunities out there, aren't there?
You mean on the market?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think since June last year, over the past 9 months, investors have spent a lot of time trying to search for the stocks which they think could benefit over the coming years after Brexit, and also disregarding Brexit, what as technology develops are the best stocks to be buying into? No one really seems to be. There's no one certain answer at the moment, though. That's one. As we move forward 9 months after Brexit, no one entirely is sure which stocks will particularly benefit. In the same way that perhaps people that you look over across in the States, and people seem to have investors really have sort of decided which sectors will benefit most from a Trump presidency.
One of the things, Bob, the other things that people have talked about, almost in parallel, we were going to be investing, and you and I have talked about this on the podcast before, in infrastructure, the roads, the big build. It hasn't happened so far, has it? Is it likely to, do you think?
Well, they actually can't make their mind up about what they should invest in. Every time they put a report out, they want to build a road somewhere, there's a counter report saying, build a road, you can create more congestion. You've got to start thinking a lot more smart about this, and there's an argument in the railway industry at the moment. Do we actually want electrification with electric lines all the way down from here to South Wales, or should we actually be thinking a different way of actually producing trains, hybrid trains that can run on batteries or on fuel cells? You've got to make that sort of next leap, and this is the argument about HS2. Can we be assured that the people running HS2 are actually going to be providing the next generation technology, or when it gets built by 2025, it's already out of date?
That's the big problem, though, isn't it? It probably is out of date. If you look at some of the first group serving the West Country, they're the old slam dunk doors. I mean, goodness me.
I know it's a bugbear of yours, Robert, as you go down to your mansion in the Southwest.
I knew that was going to come up. I just knew.
But yes. They are getting some new trains from next year. The problem is Network Rail has forgotten to actually electrify the line in time, so they won't be running it there as best they could.
How much of a problem, like you say, in terms of taking the long view, is the fact that so much infrastructure investment seems to almost be a short-term political gain taken by, obviously, the prime example still fresh in everyone's mind is the former Chancellor George Osborne, who used budget statement after budget statement to please certain MPs by announcing investment projects into infrastructure within their constituencies. But also there are certain MPs who could do with pleasing their constituents by getting a win on a certain campaign. Do you think that's damaging to the long term?
Yeah, of course it is. And politicians by nature are short term. There is a long-term issue where the Treasury hasn't got any money. How are they actually going to afford these infrastructure promises that they're actually making?
Callum, in your case in particular, we've seen Lloyd's of London has now said it's going to Brussels. Many more in the industries that you cover, Bob, probably. There seems to be a trend now that we're going to be hearing this. We've got to get used to that, the fact that people have to move staff abroad to deal with the situation.
I think that's right. And I think if you speak to people in the city, it's not a case of whether they're going to be moving workers elsewhere to deal with Brexit. It's a case of how many staff they're moving. And I think I always think back to Davos earlier this year, or forgive me, was it late last year? It's all been a bit of a blur over the past few months. But when chief executives were being very open about the fact that there was no question of the fact that they would have to respond to Brexit, but it was just a case of the devil being in the detail.
They seem to be happy to tell you in Davos. They certainly didn't want to say anywhere within the UK in case they might get pilloried. I mean, Marcus.
I think most of them were probably fairly open about, you know, functions that depended on passport and depended on serving European customers would probably have to go. There's no point waiting to see what David Davis can bring back from his negotiations with Michel Barnier. You just get on with it. There's very little downside to moving a thousand or so people to Dublin or elsewhere. So that's what you're saying with, you know, that JP Morgan were the latest to say that they're looking, they've taken out a lease, I think, with room for about 1,000 or so. And that's the question, you know, that if it is, will it stop at the number of functions, the number of people who are dealing with Europe, in which case the estimates are sort of, you know, 5%, you know, 4 to 6% of the income and workforce, which is pretty bad. You know, you don't need to be a mathematical genius to work out that equals quite a lot of hospitals and schools in terms of the UK tax base. But it's not terminal. The danger is if over time any of those new hubs develop critical mass for serving rest of world customers. And I think that's probably a longer, more strategic question. You don't see many signs at the moment that Frankfurt's ready to usurp the city. But, you know, Lloyd's of London's a good example. They'll move people because certain business there's a good chance that certain business won't be able to be written in London. That means all of the actuarial professionals, the brokers, perhaps eventually, and the capital will move with it, and the network effects could be quite important, but that's a longer term question. But it's not Project Fear anymore. It's pretty clear that people are moving jobs, and it's probably a rounding error for the city this year. I think it will be felt in a couple of years, but will it be terminal decline that some on the continent expect? I wouldn't count on it.
It's interesting that on Lloyd's of London, they were very much obviously trying to play down this week their decision to set up their headquarters in Brussels. But I was particularly interested in the fact that they said the decision of Brussels and of setting up shop there was entirely based on the need to... It's entirely based on this need for them to be near regulators and to be near the decision makers. And that was very much what they were drumming home, that very little else mattered to them. And that was why they chose Brussels.
That's a very good point, that they need to be under the regulatory umbrella. The dog that hasn't barked is Euroclearing. I mean, because it's an obscure area that few understand to do with interest rate swaps. But the numbers
does mean that they have to be their Eurozone instruments and they must be cleared in the Eurozone countries. Is that the bottom line?
That is the theory. That's the theory. But if you speak to our esteemed colleague, Harry Wilson, you said that plenty of it happens in New York every day and the ECB have no say over that. So how much of that depends on happening in a sort of regulatory, you know, under the regulatory umbrella of the ECB, I genuinely don't know, and I expect we'll find out. But if you listen to, Andreas Dombrett from the Bundesbank has said on numerous occasions that outside the single market, this, you know, Euroclearing will have to move, and that's where you get into the tens of thousands of jobs, because that's a market where hundreds of billions of dollars are traded every day.
Is there a danger? I'm going to ask each of the three of you. I mean, Bob and I are probably just about old enough, and I am older than Bob. I'll hold my hand up. But
a lot older than me.
Yeah, all right. Thank you, Bob. There's no need to really stick the boot in. But anyway, we used to refer to the brain drain. Very much people going off to the in the 70s, early 80s to America, not so much Europe, but to America. Is there a danger, each of you? I'll start with you, Bob, that a lot of the intellectual capital that we have built up, the services people in the sector of them physically moving, or do you think Britain can still create an economy where they'll feel happy to function? Or would they prefer to work abroad, do you think?
It wasn't a brain drain just in services up until relatively recently. And even now, if you go to the big R&D plants in Germany, there's a whole load of English accents. People actually left because that's where the money was. They followed the money. That's where the investment was, BMW, Volkswagen, etc. Essentially, what you have to do is to reshore that R&D, because the factory of the future doesn't have many people working in it. So you need those high-value jobs. And what the British, the automotive industry, for example, the Brits are very good at engineering and they're very good at design. But you need a Jaguar Land Rover, which is investing in this. And we don't have that many Jaguar Land Rovers in the UK.
If you speak to people in the city at the moment, and I have asked this question quite a few times, there seems to be more concern about attracting people from abroad. So they're not necessarily worried in the long term about attracting bright young things to the city from the UK and around the UK. They're quite confident they'll be able to maintain the flow of young people from across the country coming to the city. They're more worried about attracting foreign talent going forward and what Brexit will do in terms of, well, that people talk about of pulling up the drawbridge, and obviously politicians are making a massive push right now to make the point that London is open and people are welcome and foreign talent is more than welcome to set up shop here. But that message is the one they're really, really worried about not necessarily playing out as well as politicians are hoping.
I'd probably agree with that. You hear a lot more concern from people about the ability to keep attracting talent from Europe and unskilled labour from Europe as well. But Bob's point, I think, is an interesting one about, you know, because we have outsourced so much to the private sector, and because so many of our biggest companies are quoted and therefore judged frequently and on a daily basis by financial metrics, there is, I think, a sense, you know, that possibly there's a poverty of ambition. And so, you know, you're talking about battery technology and infrastructure and whether, you know, the whatever fills the place of HS2 will be the train of the future. All of this is, you know, cost benefit analysed to the nth degree. The big companies, the most money that's getting chucked at the cutting edge battery technology is private. It's not from the quoted sector. You know, and historically, a lot of the best British science and engineering and technological breakthroughs came out of state funded or state managed projects. And we no longer, you know, it doesn't seem that we have the will to be, you know, to be, perhaps it's a good thing that there's not a state backed institute looking at battery technology. Maybe it's not, you know, maybe that's not the place of the state anymore. But I think it's a moot point that we're asking universities, for example, to be more wedded to the needs of industry, who in turn are more wedded to the needs of fund managers, you know, who in turn are under the cosh to produce figures on a quarterly basis. And that doesn't leave much room for, you know, the sort of the mission to Mars or whatever it might be, or the next graphene, or the next, you know, radar technology, whatever it happens to be. I can sort of hear Land of Hope and Glory playing in the background already.
Not allowed to pay, it's copyrighted. I'm sure it is. And then I'd be in trouble with our legal friends. And let's face it, they will win whatever happens. And it's a good point to end it on. Thank you all very much indeed. I hope that's a reasonably optimistic note to end on. And remember, you can keep up to date with all the news and analysis as it happens on your phone, your tablet, and please, in the paper. If you'd like to become a subscriber, just simply go to thetimes.co.uk. If you want to hear us weekly, you can subscribe through iTunes, and do feel free to post your comments. We'd love to hear from you. My thanks to Robert Lee, Marcus LaRue and Callum Jones. Please do follow them. They're all on Twitter and they'll keep you up to date. Join us again next week. Please do. And thanks for listening.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.